You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to Brookings. I'm Michael Hanlon with the Foreign Policy Program. Great to see you all out here on a day that's evocative of a nice warm afternoon in Kinshasa. And we're going to talk about the future of the Democratic Republic of Congo, a wonderful country that Tony Gambino and I had the great privilege of serving in as Peace Corps volunteers. I'll introduce each of the panelists in just a moment. Tony also has gone back many times. We have Tom Perriello, who's the president's special envoy to the Great Lakes region of Africa, and the ambassador. But I will speak about each one of these fine gentlemen in just a moment with a little bit more detail as we prepare to get into our discussion. Let me just frame things for you a little bit today. This is sort of a usual Brookings event where the policy questions before us will be, in fact, the future of the DRC and especially the future of its politics in a year when, just like our own political system, the DRC is supposed to have an election. And yet that is in considerable doubt at the moment, as most of you probably know by virtue of being here and interested in the first place. But for those who wandered by or for those who are channel surfing and getting tired of watching beach volleyball or something at the Olympics, let me just say that right now we have at least the formal expectation of a November 2016 election in DRC, just as we do in the United States. But that is in considerable doubt. The incumbent president, Joseph Kabila, who's been in office since 2001, and therefore has served now virtually two entire elected terms plus one previous term that he essentially inherited when his father was assassinated and he took office back at the very beginning of the century. He's still a young man. He's only 45 years old. And there is speculation as to whether President Kabila is intentionally delaying these elections in order to figure out a way to stay in office longer, perhaps even rethink the constitution of DRC to allow for more than two terms. Like most countries, Congo has a constitution that only allows for two formal presidential terms. Because Kabila started in essentially inheriting his father's term in office, he has done the equivalent of three terms already. But there's the question as to whether he, like other presidents in the Central African region that we've discussed at times here at Brookings with Tony Gambino and the Honorable Tom Perriello before, he may also try to stay longer. This is an issue all over the world, we know. We know that President Putin found a way to come back into office. We know that President Museveni in Uganda just celebrated, if that's the right word, his 30th year in office. We know that President Paul Kagame, who helped end the Rwanda genocide in 1994, is still in office and has aspirations perhaps to stay even longer than Vladimir Putin may be able to keep himself in the Kremlin. This is a problem because for American foreign policy, we don't know what to do about it. Because some of these leaders, and we'll get to whether President Kabila belongs in category A or B or C in a moment, some of these leaders have done good things for their country. And one could acknowledge that Kabila himself has presided over a period in which DRC has become somewhat more peaceful. And yet it has huge enduring challenges. And so the question is Kabila really the right guy to keep going forward? Does he really have aspirations to keep going forward? Exactly where are we in the politics of this country? So that's a brief primer. I'm going to get out of the way here in just a second and let the panelists speak to you. One more thing, though, about the rules of the road here this morning. The Congolese ambassador, Ambassador Baudouin-Wayne, who is a very distinguished, long-standing servant of his country and has been ambassador to a number of countries in South Asia, most recently India, also Southeast Asia, South Africa, various jobs at the UN, long-standing under several Congolese presidents, or I guess I should say I think three Congolese presidents. He will speak in French. His English is excellent. We've been speaking in English before, but given the sensitivities of these topics, he's asked for the opportunity to make sure he gets every single comma and every single participle exactly correct, because we're talking about sensitive matters that obviously affect his country and its relationship with the rest of the world, including the United States. So seated to his right is an interpreter who will help couch his remarks in English after he has expressed them formally in French. We're going to do opening comments, They'll be in the vicinity of 10 or 12 minutes each, perhaps, but whatever people choose. And then we'll have a little discussion amongst ourselves before we go to you. So with that as background, let me say just a couple more words about each of these individuals, who, again, you can read about in the materials that were provided out front. But my good friend Anthony Gambino has been a lifelong advocate for, activist regarding, and servant of the people of DRC, as well as the people of the United States. He's done a number of jobs in U.S. government that have concerned former Zaire, now Democratic Republic of Congo. As I said, he and I were Peace Corps volunteers together there some 30-plus years ago. He never lost the bug for Congo. He worked with AID many years. He was the country director for AID in DRC about 15, 16, 18 years ago, somewhere in that range, around the turn of the century, about when Kabila was perched to come into office, and has stayed involved in Congo ever since. He was an election observer in the 2006 elections, which is now the presidential election once removed, and was the first one that President Kabila won through the ballot box, first time he became in office officially as his own man, elected president by official procedures. The Honorable Tom Perriello is a former congressman from the state of Virginia. He's been now serving for President Obama and Secretary Kerry as the envoy to the Great Lakes region of Africa for a couple of years. We had him here last fall when he spoke about also Burundi and Rwanda at particularly delicate moments. Also countries, as I mentioned earlier, with Kagame and Rwanda, but also in the case of Burundi, that have had presidents who have sought to stay on longer than we might have preferred with a two-term construct in our own thinking about democracy. But that's not, I'm not trying to say what Tom's going to say. This is his mandate is to think about these countries and the entirety of their problems, including their violence, the fact that all of these countries have been in a considerable degree of instability, and obviously the United States wants to do what it can to help stabilize this crucial part of Africa. I should say that DRC, before I mention the ambassador here in a moment, DRC is, as I think most of you know, one of the three or four pivotal states of Africa by any measure. Its population is now about 80 million, plus or minus. That puts it third after Nigeria and Ethiopia on the continent. Its landmass is second only after Algeria, now that Sudan has split in two. And of course, Algeria is largely desert, which means DRC is far and away the largest country in terms of available arable land with a lot of resources on it in all of Africa. And of course, we all used to hear 15, 20 years ago about how this was the place where there had been sort of a great war or a great interstate war in Africa, because DRC borders, I think, 9 different countries, and it's right there in the middle of the continent. So it's maybe only a slight exaggeration to say that as DRC goes, so goes much of Africa, certainly Central Africa. And then Ambassador Balumwene, as I mentioned earlier, has served his country with distinction now in the diplomatic corps for roughly a quarter century. He's a native of the Kasai region of South Central DRC. He went to college in Kinshasa. He's, as I say, served overseas in much of South and Southeast Asia, in New York City, in South Africa, and he's been President Kabila's representative or ambassador to the United States since last summer. So I think given the distinctive resumes we've got here, and just as a way to stop myself and make a clean break, let me please ask you to join me in welcoming them all to Brookings. And so now we'll work down the line, starting with Anthony Gambino.
Thank you, Mike. It's a pleasure to be here again and to share the podium with Special Envoy Perriello and Ambassador Balumwene. The Special Envoy is a global leader in working with the Congolese to find a pathway to peace. All of us are tremendously grateful for what he's doing. We had a similar meeting at Brookings last November, and I stated then that Congo was already in an electoral crisis last November. Sadly, the situation has only deteriorated. Congo today is roughly 1 month away from a full-fledged constitutional crisis. So this morning, I'll try to do 3 things. First, I'll briefly talk about the critical constitutional issues. Second, I will discuss the views of civil society, both Congolese and American, on what to do. And third, I'll offer some closing thoughts on how to move forward. Of course, I represent no one but myself in these remarks. First, the facts of this crisis. Perhaps the most important thing that I'd ask you to remember is this crisis is entirely manufactured. Congo should not be at this point. The Congolese constitution is clear. The Congolese presidency is term limited. No one can serve more than 2 5-year terms. President Kabila, therefore, is nearing the end of his final term, as Mike indicated in his opening comments. No one, and I mean no one, including those who support President Kabila, disputes this. Presidential elections must be held every 5 years. Congo already has had two elections, as Mike said, 2006, 2011, in fulfillment of the constitutional requirement. On February 12, 2015, last year, the Congolese Independent Electoral Commission, that I'll refer to by its French initials as CENI, published a comprehensive electoral calendar. It scheduled presidential and National Assembly elections for November 27, 2016, with the inauguration of the new president on December 20th, 2016. Yet today we find ourselves in a situation where Congo is not ready for the constitutionally required presidential election of 2016. Why is that? What's the problem? Well, last November, this is what I said. I stated that President Kabila's supporters have been doing everything they can to obstruct, delay, and undercut the holding of national elections on time. Judged by their actions, this group has only one aim, keeping the president in power as long as possible. Regrettably, nothing has happened to suggest even the slightest alteration in that statement from last November. Rather, President Kabila himself has recently reinforced this by stating in Uganda just the other week that Congo will have an election. He didn't specify even whether it would be local or national, after the preparation of a new voter roll. Well, what's wrong with that? Here's what's wrong. The preparation of the new voter roll is scheduled for completion about a year from now. As I already stated, the president's term, his final term, expires on December 19th in a few months. Also earlier this year, the president obtained a ruling from the Constitutional Court stating that he can remain in office until his successor is inaugurated. However long that takes is how he interprets it. I won't discuss the debate around the merits of that decision, other than to say that the opposition and Congolese civil society reject this interpretation. Recent actions by the Congolese government to remove Ida Sawyer, the Human Rights Watch researcher based in Congo, who is renowned for the quality and objectivity of her work, as well as dubious legal actions taken against the leading opposition presidential candidate, Governor Moise Katumbi, reinforce that the Congolese government is moving in the wrong direction and isn't taking the serious steps required to create an atmosphere of confidence that it will respect the Constitution. I now want to focus on an article of the Constitution that's so clear and so important that it's not subject to any ambiguity or debate about its meaning. Again, no one disputes this. It's Article 73 of the Congolese Constitution, which states in its entirety, I'm reading the entire article right now, quote, "The electoral period for the election of the President of the Republic is convened by the Congolese Independent Electoral Commission 90 days before the expiration of the mandate of the incumbent president," period. Done. That's the entire article. The English translation is a bit awkward. We do it differently under our system, but for those of us who are Americans here, let me briefly note that the Congolese system is like that of many other countries in that there's a defined electoral period leading up to an actual vote, in this case, that for a presidential election. That period, when and how long, is constitutionally mandated, described by Article 73. Therefore, the CENI must convene or declare the beginning of the official electoral period leading up to the presidential election no later than September 20th, about a month from now. Unsurprisingly, that date was on the calendar that electoral commission published last February. The present head of the Electoral Commission, Kone Nanga, had an historic opportunity to do this and fulfill his solemn constitutional obligation. Sadly, he hasn't proven to be up to the straightforward task of fulfilling his constitutional role. Instead, he came to Washington this spring and complained, I was in the meetings, he complained that he didn't know what to do. On the one hand, he said, if I go in a certain direction, the government will criticize me. But if I go in the other direction, the opposition will criticize me. What should I do, he asked. Well, what he should have done was read the Congolese Constitution, which states unambiguously what he must do in about 1 month. However, Mr. Nanga and other members of that commission have stated repeatedly that they will not be ready to do so. Therefore, I'm sorry to have to say right now that whatever statements anyone makes anywhere around September 20th, the Congo is in a full-fledged constitutional crisis as the fall begins. That's as sure as we're sitting here right now. What should the international community do? The U.S. has already begun a process of sanctions. The first round, taken against just one man, has already proven very effective. It's time now, this month, for the next round of sanctions. The type of persons to be sanctioned should be those who provide the most crucial assistance to President Kabila's unconstitutional effort to remain in power. For example, the head of the intelligence service, Caleb Moutonde, or perhaps another person central to the regime, the head of the parastatal Gécamines, Albert Yuma. It's also time for the European Union to move to impose sanctions against these unconstitutional actions by Congo's leaders to violate human rights, close political space, and undermine constitutional democracy. Let me also talk about the African Union. They've designated a facilitator, Adam Kodjo, to try to bring the sides together, and Mr. Kodjo has been at work for a long time, many months. Right now, Congolese bishops also are consulting with politicians to see if there's sufficient common ground for a dialogue to occur. The essential problem is agreeing on what is to be discussed and whether the discussion will occur in good faith. The opposition, frankly, doubts the sincerity both of the Congolese government and of Mr. Kodjo. But today, some opposition leaders are talking with Mr. Kodjo and the bishops, while others refuse to consider a dialogue as long as Kodjo remains the facilitator. Many people have called on the Congolese government to build confidence in this process by opening political space through the release of political prisoners and encouraging the participation of major political actors such as Governor Katumbi. To date, the government has not done this, and in the absence of any confidence-building measures, frankly, it's difficult to imagine a successful dialogue. I'll say a bit more about this at the end of my remarks. Let me now move to the Congolese opposition and civil society. First, I want to emphasize a really important point, crucial, that usually is overlooked. The Congolese opposition, political and civil society, is entirely peaceful. All of its leaders have embraced the principle of nonviolence. How important is that in a country that's been torn apart by multiple wars and rebellions over the last few decades? And it's still not completely at peace in parts of eastern Congo. We were just reading about horrific killings around the eastern city of Beni just the other day. The opposition's courageous stance of nonviolence must be celebrated, cherished, nourished, encouraged, and protected. Unfortunately, the Congolese police and military have garnered a global reputation for brutality, violence, and lawlessness. Remarkably, they respected the opposition's right of peaceful assembly last month when opposition leader Etienne Tshisekedi returned to Kinshasa and when he and other opposition leaders held an enormous peaceful rally a few days after his return. It wasn't an accident. U.S. sanctions against Kinshasa's police chief, Celestin Kanyama, helped provide a very important incentive for greatly improved behavior when the police saw themselves to be in the international spotlight. But make no mistake, the police and military remain armed and dangerous. The opposition has stated its intention to continue such protests if Congo moves into a period of unconstitutionality this fall. Their right to peaceful assembly must be respected. And in that regard, I also want to say thank goodness for MONUSCO, the United Nations peacekeeping force, which still has about 20,000 armed men and women in Kinshasa and based around the country. They also played a key role recently in keeping the peace by deploying around Kinshasa to make it clear that they were watching as these major rallies took place. MONUSCO has two strategic priorities mandated by the United Nations Security Council. The first is the protection of civilians. The second is to support, I'm quoting, the creation of an environment conducive to peaceful, credible, and timely elections. MONUSCO needs to be prepared to act during this upcoming dangerous period to protect civilians and promote a constitutional solution to Congo's current growing crisis. As we've said, President Kabila's final term ends on December 19th. In the absence of any constitutional solution, the opposition has called for public protests throughout the fall. If no solution has been found by December 19th, the opposition has called for the president's departure from office. President Kabila already has indicated his intention to remain. So can this crisis be avoided? What's the way forward? In ending, I have a few suggestions. First, there's neither the time nor the need for a wide-ranging discussion of multiple issues in any dialogue that might begin. The only issues for discussion among Congo's political leaders are these two. First, how to arrange for, and I'm quoting the relevant UN Security Council resolution, a free, fair, credible, inclusive, transparent, peaceful, and timely electoral process, which respects the Congolese constitution. Second, if somehow that process cannot be completed by December 20th, then what happens? I will not get into the debate of all the details of what could happen under the second scenario, but I'll make two points. First, the Congolese constitution has to be respected. Therefore, any solution of what to do after the 19th needs to follow and respect the constitution. Second, if one does that, that requires the holding of presidential elections, if not in 2016, as early as possible in 2017. No delay beyond that is possible, period. That should be a given, really not subject to any debate or discussion. Congo is entering a period of maximum danger, and it's crucial, therefore, that a way forward be found that respects the Constitution and avoids bloodshed. I really believe that with good faith and continued efforts by the Congolese elite and the people of the Congo, by governments like my own, led by people like Special Envoy Perriello, by critical international organizations like the UN, the African Union, the European Union, and other concerned citizens and groups around the world, finding a peaceful way forward, a path of peace, while difficult, still remains possible. Thank you.
Thank you, Tony. Very powerful. Congressman Perriello, over to you, my friend.
Thank you for having me, and thanks for doing this event. It's a particularly important time to be trying to get attention around the world to the situation in DRC, where the clock is ticking. Because I want to make sure there's time for the audience to participate, I'll probably just say a few remarks, plus my statements are out in the press all the time, so people kind of know where I come down on this. We used to call, when I was living in Sierra Leone, we would actually call August Africa Month, because it was one of the few times you could actually break through with news about Africa into the international press. Unfortunately, as you noted at the beginning, we can't compete with beach volleyball. I have neither the talent nor the height to do so, but this is a crucial time. Let me just make a general comment about the constitutional position that Obama's put out there, a specific point about why this applies in DRC, and then something about where we stand. President Obama did not pull this issue of term limits out of thin air. Yes, he's a constitutional law professor and believes in the importance of that as a fundamental breakpoint, but the U.S. government also ran data on this, and we showed that in countries where incumbents try to change the rules to stay in power, those countries are five times more likely to face violence and instability. Those countries that have transitions are far more likely to see economic growth and both foreign direct investment and internal economic growth. The data is very clear on this. Even in situations where there is broad consent about extending an incumbent's range in power, like a Nelson Mandela kind of situation, even in those situations, the data suggests that alternance is crucial for both stability and investment. But this is even more true in situations where there is not broad consent. I think it's fair to say, even under the most generous reading of the current political situation in DRC, as we'll discuss, that there is not some groundswell of grassroots support for a change to the constitution or a replacement. Unfortunately, we know this not just from the data, but we know this from next door in Burundi, where President Nkurunziza, who was a very popular president at the time of his decision to change the constitution and barrel forward with what was a controversial decision. Even in that situation, you saw the disintegration of stability in 10 years of progress on post-conflict reconciliation, 10 years of unbelievably courageous work by the Burundian people across faith communities, private sector, and the military to get beyond some of the divisions of the past. So this was not a randomly selected policy by the president. It also happens to be one of his most popular among the African people polled across all countries, though not as popular among African leaders, as you may guess. Secondly, I think it's important to look at this issue about alternance and the concept in the context of the Democratic Republic of Congo. There's some discussion about, you know, what role the U.S. has to play in imposing such a position. But the benefit in this situation is we're not. Our policy is entirely determined by the Congolese constitution, by the Congolese amendment about term limits, and by the overwhelming popular support in every poll and every bit of research and analysis that the Congolese people are very proud of their constitution. And they're very excited to have an election and have the opportunity to alternance, not based on any personal animosity towards a leader, but based on a belief that one of the great products of President Kabila and his family has been to establish a constitutional democracy and that this is an opportunity to turn the corner. It's also important to note, and I think His Excellency President Kabila deserves a lot of credit for this, we've seen a diversity of civil society and in the media in the DRC that is unrivaled within the region. It's a country where, I think to the credit of the government, there has been over recent years real space for civil society, real space for opposition parties, and real space for the media. Unfortunately, over the last year, we've seen significant closing of that space, including intimidation and arrest of youth activists, which tends to be obviously a sign of desperation of a weak regime, not signs of a strong regime. And I think this is not just unfortunate in terms of raising the risk of instability, but of undermining a really proud legacy that the DRC generally and President Kabila specifically have helped to establish. On the positive side, though, as was noted, we've seen over and over again that the Congolese people are ready for constitutional democracy and embrace it. There's not, we sometimes hear arguments from the government that make me believe we have more confidence in the Congolese people than they do. We saw hundreds of thousands of people come out in the streets multiple times just in this month. If the police do not instigate, the Congolese people are capable of rallying peacefully, as has happened before, whether that's at the funeral of a prominent musician or the return of an opposition figure. So when we think about this assumption that if there are people exercising their constitutional rights, it leads to instability, that's a passing of the buck. The question is, what is the spark that leads to the instability? In the absence of the crackdown, the Congolese people are incredibly mature in their approach to the democratic process, which is a good thing. Unfortunately, though, while there's much to be said about the positive success story of DRC, we do see tensions rising. We have seen prominent Congolese leaders intimidated or run out of the country, or in the case of youth activists, still sitting in prison. We also see rising concerns both in the country and among the neighbors about the introduction of inflation, about concerns about budgetary finances in the government, and a concern that even under the best of political stability and certainty, some of these are issues that could have real human impacts in a country where many, many people still remain extremely poor and on the informal economy, but also looking at the questions of regional stability. So that leads me to where we stand right now. And while I share most, if not all, of what Tony outlined as the downside risks, which are very real, if we do not find a negotiated solution in this case, I think these very disturbing scenarios which could involve violence are real, I think it's also important to keep an eye on the positive story here. It is not past the point where DRC could have its first peaceful democratic transition in the history of the country. This is an incredible turning point for the DRC. And again, I think it is one where President Kabila and his family would deserve heroic credit, where MONUSCO would deserve props, and most of all, the Congolese people would deserve the opportunity to see what country after country has seen, which is after a brutal civil war or regional war, seeing that first period of alternance is often the turning point where you start to see real gains on stability, real gains on investment, real gains in stability in all of these areas. So we do need to be extremely concerned about the downside risks, but I also want us to keep in mind the possibility of DRC as a great success story and talking about Congolese exceptionalism. Sometimes we look at the fact that other leaders in the region have done this, and therefore why is President Kabila different, and see that in sort of a negative light. Well, think about it in a positive light. What if DRC continues to become the model of a more democratic and open society, a model of a stronger constitutional democracy? We all know the natural capital and human capital is there for that opportunity. So I think we want to be supportive of both the government and the Congolese people in what could be an extremely exciting time. That having been said, I think the window for that happy story, the window for that positive step is narrowing and narrowing quickly. Some deadlines have come and gone, but the current one appears to be now until September 19th, where at least some significant leaders in the opposition feels that is the beginning of the constitutional crisis. That means we are looking now at a, you know, four to six week period, depending on when you see this coming together, where tensions will calcify, sides will calcify, and we're already seeing that in terms of confidence in both areas. There's an opportunity right now for everybody in this scenario to walk away a winner, depending on how you define winning. To me, if President Kabila gets to be one of the great heroes on the continent of seeing his country into a period of peace, into a period of constitutional democracy, and showing the statesmanship to go while he's still young enough to remain a major power broker in the country and across the continent, and could even have a comeback in years to come, that to me is a great outcome for him and certainly for the country. The problem is, the closer this gets to a conflict dynamic, the closer this gets to being decided in the streets, those opportunities disappear. His option sets get worse, not better, as this gets closer to a crisis. But there is a lot of needing to help people see those opportunities. And the next few steps, and this is where Tony and I sometimes disagree a little bit, these steps are going to be determined not by the U.S. and not by the international community, but by the Congolese people. The international community can affect things on the margin. We can try to incentivize protecting open political space. We can try to encourage what a hero's departure looks like and other things. But ultimately, this is going to be a chapter written by the Congolese people. And we hope it's one that's written together. And I think that's just where I want to end. There's a lot of talk about the Kodjo dialogue, and we fully support it. And we think it's incredibly important that everyone participate in it. Is it a dialogue? Is it a negotiation? Is it the Kodjo? Is it the support team? I understand why all those details matter. But ultimately, what matters most at this point is people making the acts of statesmanship and compromise that bring everyone to the table and allow for a negotiated solution. And I do believe that the power to do so right now rests overwhelmingly with the government. Yes, the opposition is a key player in this. But the conditions for dialogue are primarily being determined by the confidence-building measures that the government chooses to take or not take. A few weeks ago, they had a great opportunity where there was discussion about a significant release of political prisoners and pardoning of political opponents. This was probably the single best thing that could have happened to give the dialogue a real chance. It is very difficult for people to feel like they are being invited to a dialogue at the same time they are being intimidated and arrested. So I think at this point, when we think about this, yes, it's true, many opposition leaders are holding out on dialogue. We're pushing them to participate. But people are also in an environment where they're looking to see, are we going into a genuine negotiation about how to move a country forward according to the Constitution and the Security Council, or are we walking into a trap? And there is a trust gap right now, and both sides have legitimate reasons to see the other side as the bad guy, the reason that we're not at dialogue, the reason there's no trust. And there's only so much we can do from the outside. I think there are actions that leaders can take right now to create genuine space between now and September 19th. After that time, I think the options and the ability to control things decline significantly. So I still think this is an opportunity for this to be one of the great chapters for DRC and for DRC to really be the model even for the whole region and see a lot of benefits come in the wake of that. But the good scenarios get less likely as we get closer to these deadlines, and the bad scenarios get more likely. So we see this next month really as a crucial period, and we hope all of us, including in the international community, will be constructive partners in that transition.
Thank you, Special Envoy Perriello. I have two quick clarifying questions, and then we'll go to the ambassador. I just wanted, I think I heard you say that were Kabila to step down, he could potentially have a comeback. Is the Constitution about two terms lifetime or two terms consecutive? Where's the limit?
It's consecutive.
Okay, so he could, in theory, step down and then run again.
He could.
And then the other question is the state of sanctions today, and maybe just a quick word maybe from each of you. Exactly where does this stand? Is the U.S. executive branch essentially invoking authorities that have been there a while, or is this due to very recent congressional action? If I could start with you, Mr. Special Envoy, and then Tony could say a quick word.
We've had an executive authority for a few years now that includes both threats of violence, instability, gross human rights abuses, but also undermining of democratic institutions and the democratic process. The recent sanction of Police Chief Kanyama was done under those auspices. Separately, Capitol Hill has been engaged in the debate over sanctions, calling in a bipartisan way for stronger consequences in some of these areas related to these issues. I think that's, again, in our co-equal branches will continue to be both actions there. We all know that ultimately the Hill controls the power of the purse. Those of us who are in the House of Representatives like to remind everyone that starts in the House of Representatives, the People's House. My friends in the State Department don't always like being reminded of that. Yes, so the Hill ultimately can look at budget authority, but there is existing executive authority under an executive order to pursue individual sanctions and consequences.
Thank you. Anything you want to add? And my last clarifying point, earlier I said that Congo is the third most populous country in Africa. Technically, it would be the fourth if you count Egypt, but it's the third most populous in sub-Saharan Africa. So thank you for waiting, Mr. Ambassador. Over to you, good sir.
Okay, thank you. La question qu'on pose aujourd'hui pour sur la RDC est comment comprendre la situation relative au processus électoral en RDC aujourd'hui.
So what we like to clarify today is how the electoral process works in the DRC, and I would like to give some clarification on the situation.
Après les exposés de mes co-panélistes, Monsieur Thomas Perriello et Gambino,
After the presentations of Mr. Thomas Perriello and Mr. Anthony Gambino, I would like to say
clarifications.
I would like to give some clarifications on the five following points.
Qui est le pouvoir organisateur des élections en RDC?
Who has the organizational power over the elections in the DRC?
Pourquoi il y a un retard dans le processus électoral?
Why do we have a delay in the electoral process?
Quel est le bien fondé du dialogue national inclusif?
What is the validity of the inclusive national dialogue?
L'interprétation de l'article 90, alinéa 2 de la Constitution.
The interpretation of Article 70, second paragraph of the Constitution.
Et enfin, je parlerai de l'irrationalité de la guerre ou des troubles en RDC après décembre 2016, comme le prédit certains opposants.
And after, I'm going to talk about the irrational war and the troubles of the DRC after December 2016.
Notre Constitution, dans son article 211, confie à la CENI l'organisation des élections en République démocratique du Congo.
The dispositions of the Article 211 of the Constitution, the organization of the elections of the DRC, and it will explain the competence of the CNI, which is the National Commission of the Independent Electorate.
Mais cette, la Commission nationale indépendante rencontre des obstacles pour que les élections soient organisées en temps réel du fait de deux grands obstacles.
Actually, the CNI, which is the National Commission of the Independent Electorate, has some obstacles to face.
Le premier, il est d'ordre technique.
The first one is a technical one.
Vous vous rappellerez bien que on a eu déjà deux élections au Congo en 2006 et en 2011.
So we had two elections, the one in 2006 and the one in 2011.
En 2006, on a eu des élections avec la participation de nos partenaires extérieurs.
In 2006, we had help in the elections from external partners.
Les choses se sont très bien passées.
Things went really well.
Déjà à l'époque, je veux vous rappeler que les élections étaient prévues en 2005, mais pour des raisons techniques, on a avancé ça en 2006.
And actually, the elections were foreseen to be held in 2005, but we actually postponed them and they were held in 2006.
Alors, techniquement, aujourd'hui, la CENI, qui après les mauvaises élections 2011,
technically, the CENI, which is the National Commission of the Independent Electorate, had foreseen the elections in 2011.
Dont le fichier électoral était contesté par tout le monde à la fin.
And actually, everybody was against it and contested it to help the elections in 2011.
D'où l'impératif devoir de refaire, de reconstituer un nouveau fichier électoral dans le pays afin d'accéder à un processus électoral crédible.
That's why we decided to reorganize the election process and have a credible process.
La deuxième raison, parce que pour renouveler les fichiers électoraux, nous avons à peu près 42 millions d'électeurs qu'on doit enregistrer.
The second issue, we have 42 million people to register to vote.
Dans lesquels il y a plus de 10 millions de jeunes ou de nouveaux adultes.
And we have 10 million new young people, young adults to register.
Et aujourd'hui, la loi accepte aussi que les Congolais à l'étranger puissent aussi voter.
And now the new law is that also the Congolese people that live in foreign countries have the right to vote.
Alors pourquoi ces fichiers et tout ça n'a pas été fait depuis 2011? C'est la question qu'on pose continuellement.
So the question now is why didn't we all process that already in 2011?
Les élections de 2011 ont eu lieu à la fin de l'année, donc c'est le 20 décembre que le président a prêté serment, 20 décembre 2011.
The elections were held at the end of 2011, in December 2011.
Donc, on est passé directement en 2012.
And after, we right away went into 2012.
Les choses fonctionnaient correctement.
And things were functioning fine.
Et l'argent pour les élections futures était déjà mis de côté.
And the funds for the future elections were set apart.
En 2013 et 2014, le Congo va affronter une rébellion de M23.
In 2013 and 2014, we were facing a war, a rebel war, M23.
Devant cette situation de fait,
before this situation,
l'État avait le devoir impérieux de protéger le territoire national, l'intégrité territoriale.
Because of less funds, it was a difficult situation to prepare the elections.
Et pour se défendre, il faut des moyens et il faut de l'argent.
to organize, we need funds and we need money.
Le budget a été affecté à ces propos.
And the budgets were affected.
Deuxièmement, en l'année 2015-2016,
in the year 2015 and 2016,
il y a malheureusement une économie extravertie.
We had a very difficult economy.
Où nous dépendons complètement de ce que nous exportons.
We were completely depending on everything that we were exporting. We were completely dependent on our export.
Vous avez suivi jusqu'à ces jours la baisse des cours des matières premières.
And we saw a decline in prices of raw materials.
Le cuivre principalement.
Especially copper.
Et le pétrole.
And petrol.
Notre budget a été revu à la baisse.
Our budget had to be down. It was revised down. Sorry.
Voilà les questions qui ont compliqué la RDC de se préparer depuis 2011 calmement pour préparer les élections de 2016.
I would like to explain again that we had time to prepare the elections of 2011, and the same situation is happening in 2016.
Dans tout ceci, il faut aussi mettre aussi le comportement de notre opposition en matière de rejet continuel de toute proposition, soit de calendrier, soit de dialogue.
Also, we have to look at the opposition in terms of the calendar that we were proposing and other questions.
Aujourd'hui, tout le monde parle de 20 décembre, Kabila doit partir. C'est ça le refrain que le monde entier est en train de claironner.
Everybody now talks about the month of December, the month that President Kabila should leave office.
Et réellement, Kabila est en fin terme de ces deux mandats successifs, constitutionnellement parlant.
Actually, the end of his term will be in that period, end of December.
Mais tous ceux qui parlent de départ de Kabila le 20 décembre, ils ne donnent aucune solution pour la suite. Qu'est-ce qui va se passer au Congo? Et c'est ça la grande question.
Everybody that's talking about the end of his term of President Kabila is not talking about what should happen next. They don't give any solution what should happen afterward.
Or, aujourd'hui, le président Kabila dit ceci. Je convoque les dialogues pour que tous les Congolais se mettent ensemble.
President Kabila is proposing that we should have a dialogue. What should happen next?
Pour préparer la feuille de route qui va nous permettre tous d'aller aux élections. Paisible.
So we can prepare the way and to go to the electoral process in a peaceful way.
Et au terme de quel le président élu va prendre fonction dans ce pays au Congo.
And after the elected president will take function and start his new term.
Donc la grande question c'est qu'est-ce qui se passe après le 20 décembre?
So the big question is, what will happen after the end of December?
Il y a deux grandes options aujourd'hui.
There are two options, important options, possible today.
Le président Kabila avec le gouvernement dit, mettons-nous ensemble, cherchons une prolongation. Une prolongation, ce n'est pas un nouveau terme. Il faut qu'on se comprenne bien.
We could have the solution that we would prolong his term.
Je répète, je dis bien que la prolongation, c'est-à-dire que le temps après le 20 décembre, c'est presque un an, pour préparer ensemble les élections, ce n'est pas un nouveau terme qu'il cherche.
He is not looking for a new term, it's a prolonging of his existing term after December.
Et ça aussi, c'est conformément à notre constitution qui dit que le président qui est en fonction reste jusqu'au jour où on a élu un autre président et il passe les pouvoirs.
This is also confirmed the constitution that the president can continue with his existing term till we have elected a new president.
L'autre option, la deuxième, qui est surtout commanditée par nos amis de l'opposition, plus certains partenaires étrangers.
The second solution can be found together with the opposition and also external partners.
C'est utiliser la rue. Utiliser la rue, d'en faire une révolution de masse pour chasser dans les désordres, certainement, le président Kabila.
To use the street and the protest in the street, and that would eventually push Kabila out.
Alors, cette solution, on peut savoir comment ça peut commencer, mais personne, et alors personne, ne sera en mesure d'assurer l'après le chaos qui va arriver là, à ce moment-là.
Nobody could foresee what a chaos this would create.
Alors, pour terminer, je vais tout simplement dire que le Congo, c'était un grand pays en Afrique. Il faudra beaucoup plus veiller à sa stabilité, veiller à ce qui reste intègre pour qu'on fasse des élections propres et laisser aux générations à venir un exemple démocratique qu'il faudra.
We have to make sure, if we look at the Republic, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, should stay a stable country. And we should make sure that we look for stability and a peaceful process.
Donc l'implosion de la RDC devra à tout prix être évitée.
So we should avoid any dangerous situation, unstable situation.
Sinon, toute la sous-région de l'Afrique centrale ainsi que le comité international en ressentiront les effets néfastes.
And make sure that the things don't go out of control in this important central region of Africa.
Il n'y a aucun intérêt à créer un deuxième Libye en Afrique centrale.
We should avoid and we should not create a second Libya in Africa.
Je vous remercie.
I would like to thank you all.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ambassador. And so what I'd like to do is ask you to start getting ready with your questions, and we'll have a microphone. Once I call on you, please identify yourself, and please limit yourself to one question. If you want to pose it to a specific person, that's preferred but not obligatory. But before we do that, I'm going to ask Tony and Special Envoy Perry Arlo if they want to make any brief response to the ambassador. Tony, why don't you go ahead first?
Okay, thank you very much. First of all, I want to thank the ambassador. I think it's important that Brookings invited the representative of the government to present the views on how to move forward. And I just say a few things because I do want to get to the broader questions. The first, I don't know anyone, no governments, no international organization, no Congolese actor, be he or she in the opposition or the governments, no civil society member, be they Congolese, American, or European, who looks for the implosion of the Congo or for disaster. Everyone wants to avoid this and find a way out. And that's why I emphasize the peaceful nature of the opposition, that we do not have, thank goodness, a situation where there are armed rebellions. As let's remember, just 20 years ago we had in the Congo, we had multiple armed groups fighting over the territory of the Congo. We do not have this today. That is a great gift that has come from actions by President Kabila and others, actually, over this period to create the opportunity now. The second point I'd like to make is, as I tried to suggest, the Constitution has multiple arguments, and frankly, one does not need to be a constitutional scholar to see one's way clear. The ambassador focused on one article, Article 70, which I referred to briefly, and it's subject to multiple interpretations, but he gave the one that the Constitutional Court provided and that the government holds to. But then there's the other article that the opposition talks about and that I stated, which is Article 73. That's another article of the Constitution, every bit as valid as Article 70. And Article 73 creates a clear, unamendable obligation to the Electoral Commission to declare the process for the election of the president open 90 days before the expiration of the incumbent president's term. And that's a article of the Constitution that has no other clause that says it can be amended, that, well, you need to be ready, or maybe if you don't like it, you can do otherwise. No, it says this in black and white very clearly what needs to be done. And so if that's not done, I think just from a constitutional point of view, one falls sadly into an unconstitutional state, regardless of how one interprets Article 70. So then, of course, what we're all trying to discuss is what's the way out. And I think, if I could be so bold, I think actually we all agree that it's to find a way for particularly the political elite of the Congo. I am certainly not suggesting, and I hope I never have, that the United States should or could impose a solution on the Congo. That's not the role of the American government. And as the special envoy said, that's not what the United States is attempting to do in any way this time around. But it's for the crucial Congolese actors to come together now and have a serious discussion and compromise, because compromises will have to be made, on how to move forward. And I'll end by stating that it is my view, I'll just echo what the special envoy said, that if confidence could be created, what's lacking right now is confidence. There's a lot of mistrust around. And there have been opportunities where people have been looking for the government to take steps to show that they were ready for these kinds of difficult discussions. We have not seen those serious confidence-building measures yet. But I'll state again, as I did in my comments, what I think we all believe, it's not too late. It's very late. You know, if you're thinking of the clock ticking towards midnight, we're well past 11 p.m. I think we're past 11:30 p.m. We're maybe at 10 minutes to midnight or something, but the clock hasn't struck midnight yet.
Special Envoy Perriello, anything to add?
First of all, thank you for the comments. I think there is, as you can see, plenty of room to find a reasonable solution and consensus path forward. But if a small fire has started in the basement of your house and everyone spends their energy focused on who started the fire instead of how to put the fire out, then that fire is going to grow and it's going to get bigger. And I think right now both sides are focused a bit on establishing who started the fire instead of how to put it out. And the solution to putting it out seems very clear. There are statements President Kabila could make today that would immediately diffuse tension and create more space. There are actions he could take today that would immediately create more space for genuine dialogue. So I think if this goes in a bad direction, which we hope it does not, people will look back at this period and the actions that each side took and some of the missed opportunities by the government to build confidence in assessing that. But the focus right now shouldn't be on the blame about the fire, but how to get the fire out and make the house stronger.
Thank you. Well, let's go to you. I'm going to take two questions at a time. We'll start here in the third row, the gentleman, and then the woman in the second row. Take those two together. Still not working, I don't think. You have a different microphone?
My name is Ni Akwete. I work with the African Immigrants Caucus. And I'm taking the opportunity to look, instead of the Congo and how it moves forward, which is very important, to look at the strategy of U.S. policy in Africa. A couple of, 10 days ago, the president talked to the Yali fellows, and he was asked about how the U.S. chooses to impose sanctions on some countries for their bad behavior and not on others. And he said, well, when we have security issues, security cooperation with friends, Yeah, we cooperate with them. We don't ostracize them, but we talk to them. I think the problem with that is that then it sets a bad example. So to bring it to the Congo, my personal view is, if I were President Kabila, I'm looking at President Kagame and President Museveni and saying they have done worse things. They have stayed longer. The U.S. is not pushing them out, so why should I listen to you? That's just me, but tell me why I'm wrong.
Okay, and then here, take this one also.
My name is Marilyn Sifok, Dr. Marilyn Sifok. I'm the president of the Women Ambassadors Foundation. My comment, it's more a comment than a question, Congo was the victim of King Leopold back in the after the Berlin Conference. King Leopold took Congo as its personal property. And decimated millions of King Leopold of Belgium, decimated millions of Congolese people. A century later, we had a promising leader by the name of Patrice Lumumba. He was killed by the West. Why should Congo today take advice from the West?
You turned it into a question. That was pretty good. Okay, so why don't we start with Tony and just work down?
I'll just say something about the second question. I certainly, in what I was discussing today, was focused very much on the views and aspirations of people with whom I'm in contact who are Congolese, and trying to understand and speak to what people in the Congo are looking for now. This is a very different situation than the circumstance of the late 19th or early 20th century, when the horrors under Leopold were perpetrated, as you suggested, or the very end of the colonial period in 1960, the beginnings of the post-colonial Congo. And I think it's quite important to constantly underscore that some of us here are trying very hard. Actually, I'll speak, I think, a little more broadly for the people I work with in American civil society. We try very hard to stay in close contact with members of Congolese civil society and to understand how they see the situation, what they would like to do, and to share and exchange, and I consider it a very healthy and a very useful exchange. And it is not one, and I'm very happy about this, where it is the United States or Europe or anywhere else who is attempting with a fist to make changes, as, yes, was the case in the past. Rather, I and others want to learn from and transmit the views of the extremely courageous, articulate, and committed people in the Congo, whether it's the youth that Special Envoy Perriello referred to working in organizations like Lucha and Filimbi or many others, the larger civil society organizations represented in Kinshasa or the provinces throughout the country, active civil society gatherings that are going on now, as well as the extremely vibrant set of senior political actors and political parties that are all pushing for the kinds of things that were under discussion today. So the situation that prevails in 2016 globally is quite different than the ones you referred to in the past, and thank goodness, that's a move in a good direction.
Special Envoy Perriello, any comment?
Sure. I mean, this is obviously something that could be its own two-hour discussion. I think the question is, what are the right lessons to have learned from the past? And I think one of the lessons is could be non-engagement at all, or it could be that we should stand with the aspirations of the people, not with corrupt elites. And I think when we look at Congo, there's a clear aspiration of the people. and the United States policy has been entirely informed by the Congolese people. That doesn't always mean that everyone in the elite is going to be in touch with that. I also think the issue of non-engagement in the global world is complicated. If you look at where the investment's coming from today or the major corporate and government intervention, it's not from the West. It's from across Africa, it's China, it's other places. So if you look at the history of how the Kabila family came into power, this question about when you go back and talk about something that is essentially Congolese independent of outside or exogenous forces, as you know very well, gets extremely complicated very quickly. But I think part of what we've tried to learn from this is that in the past, when we have stood against the aspirations and wills of the people, we've regretted it, looking back. And where we've stood with people, the people of a country, we have been on solid ground. And I think there's no question in this case that the Congolese people like their constitution. They want it respected. They want an election. That just isn't being imposed from the outside. The only thing standing in the way is leaders in the own government. So I think with the question of sanctions, we've tried to get smarter about this as well. I think there's a lot more controversy about where you sanction an entire government or programs that are seen as supporting the people versus trying to be more surgical about targeting particular actors who are creating instability or limiting the rights of their own citizens. In terms of the U.S. engagement, certainly there's a lot in our history to answer for, and those are all legitimate questions to be raised. But I think in this case, it couldn't be more clear that we're standing in partnership with the Congolese people. And I think when we've tended to do that in the past, it's something that has been something we look back on positively.
Mr. Ambassador, any comments?
Yeah. Just pour dire, le président Kabila a organisé les premières élections de ce pays après l'indépendance.
I would like to say that President Kabila has organized the first elections in this country.
50 ans après, c'est lui qui a fait organiser les deuxièmes élections en 2011.
And he also organized the second elections in 2011.
Entre les deux temps, il pouvait changer la constitution pour rester au pouvoir comme les autres le font à travers l'Afrique.
He could have changed the constitution in those years if he wanted to, like a lot of other presidents in Africa have
je
done.
Je vous dis qu'il y a eu les majeurs de son parti qui ont demandé en 2009 si on pouvait changer la constitution.
There were important people in his government that have asked in 2009 to change the constitution.
Il a dit non.
But he said no.
La deuxième fois, avec la mouvance de le Rwanda qui a pris tout le temps à informer le monde entier qu'il allait changer la constitution.
Rwanda has changed the constitution.
Notre voisin direct, le Congo-Brazzaville, a pris le même processus et l'a abouti.
Our direct neighbor has done this process and they have changed the constitution.
Les grands du parti sont venus lui dire, voilà, maintenant c'est une occasion parce que tout le monde le fait. On peut le faire, il n'y aura rien.
Like a lot of times this has happened, we could have done it as well.
Il ne l'a pas fait, il a dit non.
But our president has said no.
Il a dit, je veux léguer à ce pays une culture démocratique.
I want to have a democratic culture in this country.
Mais ce que je demande, compte tenu des conditions dures actuelles pour faire les élections dans le temps imparti,
so what I'm asking for to have these elections now.
Il faut un temps pour que tout le monde aille aux élections calmement et il y aura passation de pouvoir. Il ne va pas demander un autre mandat. Il ne sera pas candidat non plus.
We need a time to pass calmly to the next election. He will not claim a second term, nor will he stay in office.
Third term. Very good.
Okay,
let's take two more questions. Here in the second row, and then behind her in the third row, and then I'll try to work back in the following round.
Hi, my name is Brigitte Harrington, and I'm president of Harrington Dorsey. I understand how you sanction a country, but what I don't understand is how you sanction an individual.
Okay, there's a good question. And then in the third row, gentleman back in the blue shirt.
My name is Alka Matamba. I have two questions. One is for the Mr. Ambassador, and the other one is for Mr. Perillo.
Keep them short, please, then, because the rule is one question.
Sure.
So.
Well, I'm trying to combine.
Okay.
Mr. Ambassador, the question I'm asking pretty much is about the organization of the elections. You have mentioned that one of the reasons was lack of funds, because the funds were displaced for the war in the East some time ago. Would the government of Mr. Kabila accept money to organize this or this election from friends, like the United States and other European countries? To Mr. Perillo, my question is basically to clarify a little bit what you meant by negotiated a solution to the crisis in the Congo.
This is great. We have one question per panelist. So, Tony, you want to take the first?
I'll pass.
So first on the sanctions question, I think it's important to note that the U.S. sanctions only apply to things inside the United States. We cannot affect what happens inside DRC. So this only affects assets inside the United States or travel to the United States. So as a sovereign country, we have a right to make decisions about an individual to the extent that they're touching U.S.-related activities. We do not have the ability to go in and, you know, affect that vis-a-vis the DRC dynamics. In a global banking environment, some of those things do have spill-on effects. But governments have the right to do that, and travel bans and other activities and focus on individuals. I think the feeling over recent years has been when you sanction an entire government, there are at least some folks who feel like that can end up affecting the people who have not necessarily done the bad acts that are creating the negative effects. People are welcome to disagree with it, but that's the legal basis for it. And I think on the issue of, and I wanted to add just one other comment actually to the earlier thing, which I think is really important to reiterate, that is different perhaps than how some things have happened in the past, which is that the United States does not take a position on any party or any candidate in this case. I think in the past we have in some cases tried to handpick or play the chess game out. I think there are countries for good reason that are skeptical that we really mean that when we say it, but we really do. I couldn't care less whether the majority wins or the opposition wins the election. The U.S. position is that the election should happen and the Congolese people should determine the future. Not everyone around the world shares that approach to this situation, but it is our genuine belief that what's important is the process and that it's the will of the Congolese people. We've made that certainly clear to the opposition over and over again. And we've made that clear to the government as well. And I frankly think they're very competent leaders on both the majority and the opposition for that we could imagine in a variety of positions. On the issue of negotiated solution, I'm being intentionally vague because we think our answer to the question of what it should look like is whatever works. Whatever gets a broad enough consensus about how to address what is a fairly limited number of issues right now and a fairly limited time frame goes forward. The big game in town is the Kodjo dialogue, so it seems that the best way to proceed is to figure out how to take that formulation and figure out whatever tweaks need to be made to bring, you know, all the sides to the table there. But we don't go into it with a preconceived notion that there's a particular format, et cetera. We know that there are a limited number of issues, which basically come down to how soon the elections can be held, a statement of non-candidacy, and what the government looks like between December 19th and then, and the issue of whether everyone's going to be allowed to participate free of intimidation. I mean, we can come up with our list, but it's not a huge number of things. So I think from whether we don't want to get stuck on the words dialogue or negotiation or Kodjo dialogue versus African Union dialogue, I think our belief is it should be what works, and it should be what the key Congolese stakeholders accept as legitimate, and that's not for us to determine. What we can say is that the current solution isn't there yet. Clearly, we don't have all of the key actors to the table in a way that could reach a consensus solution to head off this problem. So when we say how can we look at confidence-building measures from the government, how can we push the opposition to be more open to this dialogue, I think our ultimate bottom line is what works, what brings people to the table that can find a path on this limited set of issues.
Thank you. Mr. Ambassador.
Yeah. Je vous confirme qu'en 2006, on a eu des financements extérieurs pour des élections.
I would like to confirm that in 2006, we have received external funds for the elections.
En 2011, on a eu des problèmes et l'extérieur ne nous a pas assisté. On a fait les élections à nous-mêmes. Le Congo a financé les élections de 2011 complètement.
In 2011, Congo has financed themselves the elections.
Alors maintenant, compte tenu des difficultés que j'ai annoncées, le Congo a demandé l'assistance extérieure aussi.
So now we have asked for external help, looking at the funds issues that we have.
Mais à ce jour déjà, le Congo a déjà sorti 330 millions de dollars qu'il a remis à la CENI pour le commencement du processus d'enregistrement des électeurs. C'est en cours déjà.
We already have liberated funds of $330 million dollars to start register the voters.
Et nous attendons aussi la part de nos amis extérieurs.
And we also wait for the part of our external partners.
Very good. Okay, let's take another round. So we'll go over to this side, and we'll take three this time. The gentleman in the second row, and then the two sitting next to each other in the fourth row. This may wind up being the final round, so we'll make it the lightning round. One question each, please.
Thanks for the opportunity. My name is Derek Imadi Karago, native of Washington, D.C. Question, Mr. Ambassador. Thanks for the clarity. It sounds like when, before you're trying to explain that Mr. Kabila was trying to do a transition without holding on to power. Can you name a few names of the opposition candidates that think that they're not given a fair share, and that's the reason why all this is coming up, that Mr. Kabila wants to change the constitution? Can you give us a few names? And from the last that I had, Mr. Katumbi was the biggest front runner against Mr. Kabila. If that's true, as of right now.
Thank you. And then the two in the fourth row.
Hi, Daniela Mack from the State Department, from the Bureau of African Affairs. I'm interested in if you can speak a little bit about how the U.S. government should think about its security sector reform programming going forward in light of the political uncertainties with the environment, and specifically with regards to objectives and priorities for security assistance.
Thanks.
Great. Sasha Lezhina from the Enough Project. My question is to the ambassador. There is, of course, the political crisis, but also the economic crisis with commodity prices lowered and increased inflation, which could exacerbate the political crisis. So I'm curious what the government's strategy is to try to address this economic crisis. Thank you.
Thank you. So why don't we start with the ambassador this time, and we'll work towards just take whichever question you want.
Ce que j'aimerais dire pour ce qui est de candidats, sachez déjà que ici aux États-Unis, j'ai déjà enregistré au niveau de l'ambassade plus de 7 candidats aux élections présidentielles ici aux États-Unis.
What I would like to say about the presidents that would be elected, I already have registered 7 possible candidates here in the embassy.
Au Congo, on en a plus d'une vingtaine de candidats.
In Congo, we have even like 20 candidates registered.
Et sachez que le Congo a plus de 400 partis politiques.
And you have to know that we have more than 400 political parties in Congo.
Donc, comprenez que citer les noms de gens, ils sont très nombreux. Je ne peux pas les retenir et les citer nommément.
So you will notice that this is very difficult to name some candidates, seeing the big number of possible candidates.
Celui qui a demandé que fait le gouvernement pour contenir la crise actuelle.
I'm going to talk about the economic crisis.
Ce n'est pas le Congo qui fixe les prix de matières premières à l'extérieur.
The Congo doesn't establish the commodity prices.
Comme tous les pays, du pays sous-développé.
Like all the other underdeveloped countries.
Les prix sont fixés ici en fonction des besoins.
The prices are fixed regarding the needs.
Ce que le gouvernement fait, c'est de contenir cette crise.
Like to control the crisis,
et
what we do.
Par exemple, en cherchant à diversifier son économie.
We like to diversify our economy.
Pour ne pas être dépendant en grande partie des matières qu'on exporte.
To not be too dependent on the materials that we export.
Donc voilà ce que fait le gouvernement aujourd'hui pour contenir cette crise qui vient de l'extérieur.
that's what the government is trying to do to control the crisis that comes from the outside.
Special Envoy.
First, let me just concur that the much of the economic crisis that's coming is not the government's fault. It was a lot of exogenous factors like commodity prices. Nonetheless, it does introduce another reason to be concerned about stability and about the role the street may play in coming months. So regardless of what caused that issue, it is certainly something we're tracking very closely, both for human implications for those who are living on the margins, but also the broader security and political implications. Second, on the opposition leaders, as I said before, my job is a lot easier because we're not taking sides, so I don't have to get into all of that politics. As a former politician myself, I will just say, observing it, that I actually think it's quite fascinating. I think that people will focus on how many candidates there are and people seeming to change sides, but that's not necessarily a sign of unhealthy politics. It can be a sign of healthy politics, that people will form coalitions, they'll break coalitions. Sure, I'm sure some of it will not be for the most ideologically or financially pure reasons, but nonetheless, what you're seeing, I think, a lot of in the last year is genuine coalition politics and trying to distinguish those people who do have a constituency from those people who are just an individual running around wanting to be a candidate. So as a political observer, I will just say it's really fascinating to see how dynamic that environment is. And that will only, I think, intensify over the next year. And it's not about producing the perfect candidate. It's fair to say many Americans are not content with our major party candidates here. I'm not here to comment on that. But that's, you know, that's part of how a political system works, is it's much about the parties and the coalitions that come together. On security sector reform, I think this is something the U.S. government wants to continue and is continuing to pursue as a top priority. It's something President Kabila has certainly emphasized a great deal. I think there are opportunities to see ongoing progress against the FDLR as well, where we had seen things stagnate for some period of time. And I hope that the remaining period for President Kabila, he sees as a chance to solidify some of his legacies. And I think he has many to point to. We mentioned earlier the fact that he really pushed to the Sun City Accords, which was not what people expected of him at first. He pushed for the Constitution. He allowed elections to happen. He's addressed gender-based violence within the military. And security sector reform is something else that he's raised as a priority. So I think we want to focus a lot on this political situation because it's the big elephant in the room. But it goes parallel with many of these other things. What I will say about both security sector reform, as I started out saying about economic development and foreign direct investment, is that that alternance does affect this in every country. The extent to which people feel like they've passed the period where you're in a post-conflict environment, which I think is how many people still see DRC, or is this a stable constitutional democracy? And I think the next year, however it plays out, is going to determine the extent to which we get on a path in a direction towards greater investment and greater stability. As a country that spends a lot of money supporting MINUSCO every year, no one would be more excited than us to see MINUSCO fade out over the years ahead, because the capacity exists internally to do that, because we've addressed negative forces in the East. So I think these things have to run in parallel to each other. But I think political uncertainty is rarely the ally of stability, and it's rarely the ally of these medium to long-term investments, whether it's investment in a policy like security sector reform or the economy. So again, we see this as still something that could be a great chapter for DRC, where there is a turning of the page, and I think there's lots of room for His Excellency and others to get a lot of credit for that. But if this goes badly, I think it will tarnish a lot of those positive steps that were taken and will end up being a defining moment in a different direction.
Tony.
Just a little bit about the question regarding security sector reform. Security sector reform in the Congo has been focused on for a long time with a very mixed record. It's very difficult to do. What I'd say about it now is this is not a time for mixed messages, and it's a time for focusing on priorities. So let's think about the 2006 election. the Congolese and international community were united in wanting to have good elections in 2006, but there was a sense that the army could potentially play a negative role because that command and control abilities weren't good. The ability to commit violence against civilians was unfortunately very high. And a decision was taken not to ramp up security sector reform, but that the army stay in the barracks during the electoral period, and that the police be given the role working with the MONUC, that's what the United Nations group was called at the time, to ensure the peaceful holding of elections, and it worked. The military stayed in their barracks, and the elections of 2006 were remarkably peaceful throughout the Congo. We have a similar challenge when elections will take place this time. I am not advocating the same action be taken as in 2006, not at all. 10 years have passed. But that we think about what is appropriate to be done when what we want is to see, as Special Envoy Perriello has said again and again in his comments, the alternation of power, alternance in French, therefore via elections. And we want those elections to be free, fair, credible, peaceful, transparent, et cetera. And there's a military with a record, and unfortunately, much of that record is bad. So rather than thinking about long-term goals of security sector reform, which of course are ultimately important, the essential now is to say, how can a military be part of a solution that has open political space for political expression, for peaceful demonstration, for the other things that are part of a democratic process whereby people can come together, look at the candidates, make their decision, and ultimately on election day, go and vote for the candidate of their choice.
I'm just going to add one very last point of my own in conclusion on this question, which is that even though it may not be the moment for this kind of a bigger, longer-term policy concept, I still like to argue that the United States military should consider offering up to a brigade of force. And what I mean by that is, depending on how you size it, 2,000 to 3,000 personnel, to build on the excellent model that was created in Afghanistan, something called the Security Force Assistance Brigade, where we break down the traditional warfighting unit into a number of smaller advisory teams, get out in the field with the military we're trying to help improve. And it helps you, first of all, get to know the leaders so you can provide advice to the president of that country on who he might want to promote or not promote. And it also allows you to provide in-field tactical support more in the realm of ideas and advice than in the realm of actual operations. If we're going to see the DRC military get to the point where the UN can work itself out of a job, I think the United States or some other Western country like us may need to get more involved. And the reason I say this is because there's such an allergy in Washington to even putting this idea on the table, that as a defense analyst myself, I want to say I think we're good at this now, and I actually think we can find the forces after we've drawn down so much in Iraq and Afghanistan. It wouldn't be easy for the U.S. military, but I actually think it's feasible. However, I would not propose that it be something we talk about right now with President Kabila. To me, it's more of a potential inducement to a successor president if the stars align in a number of ways on that front. Thank you all for coming out, and please join me in thanking our panelists.